Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:08 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is October 12th, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, there's been a lot of volatility this week, and there certainly has been some really quite key moves and in the various markets that we cover. And I thought I would kick off today by looking at the Nasdaq 100. Because it has bounced from the 7,000 point level in here today. Now, it was really quite volatile intraday, but we've had a significant rally in the last half hour of trading. And I was tempted to start recording the video half an hour ago, but I thought it really would be better off to just wait until we get to the close before drawing any clear conclusions. It's just one of those days. Well, what we can see on the chart here is that the Nasdaq has encountered resistance around the 7,000 level in January, then again in March, and then it started to find support around 7,000 in late June and early July, and then again in here this week. Well, this takes us straight back to the very first example from the chart seminar, which is that past support can become future resistance, but it works exactly the other way around too, that past resistance can become future support. And in fact, this is exactly what needed to happen. The Nasdaq, in order for the bull market hypothesis to remain intact, it needed to hold its breakout, and so far it has done that. So, this has been a pretty emphatic bounce. When we look at some of the largest caps, then Apple, for example, was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today, but more importantly, it has bounced off of the lower side of this evolving range. And there's still the potential that it is going to unwind this overbought condition relative to the trend mean. And there's still approximately about $25 of fat that could be taken off the share and still be within the context of a consistent medium-term advance. But we're at a stage in the cycle where we can't rule out the potential that there's going to be an acceleration higher. And considering the kind of environment that we're in right now, where there are a lot of people that have been betting that the market's advance has reached a climax, well, it's important to then kind of consider where are we in terms of the cycle? What evidence do we have that there's potentially going to be a recession? Where are the potential epicenters of risk? What kind of threat do they represent to various markets? I think that's what I want to focus on in this broadcast. So, when we look at not just the Nasdaq, I think it is important to look at the S&P 500 and the Russell 2000 as well, because the S&P 500 did pull back into its underlying range. It has completely unwound its overbought condition relative to the trend mean, and then we're starting to see just the very first evidence of support being found in here today. Well, obviously, it is too early to draw clear conclusions. This is has been another example of a massive reaction against the prevailing trend on the short term. And if we go back and simply look at what we saw in February, well, then we had a pretty impressive rally. It did not quite get all the way back to the peak, but it got about approximately three quarters of the way back up. Then we had a downside key reversal, and we had a pullback. And the downside key is just to refresh your memory, is when it moves to a new high intraday and then finishes below the low of the previous day. We saw that at the end of February, that resulted in a pullback. Then we had another key reversal at the peak in March, and that led to a retest of the low. But then we have had a progression of higher reaction lows since. It would not be at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we get a rebound over the course of the next few weeks in the major Wall Street indices that could take it back up towards the peak, but perhaps not quite above the peak. And then we get a retest of the low, and that the low should not be superseded if we're still in a bull market environment. But this kind of pullback is something that will hold up the market for at least the next few weeks, if not months. So that's the likely consideration for the wider market, and we're already seeing relative strength from the major caps within the technology sector. Well, if we look at some of the shares that had been pulling back to the region of their respective trend means, well, Google has bounced in here today from the region of its trend mean. It really did need to bounce from this area, and we're just beginning to see some evidence that that is in fact occurring. But it has a lot of work to do to really confirm that this is a more than short-term low for the price. PayPal, on the other hand, and let me type that in again, PayPal has got aspirations of increasing its consumer base up to 1 billion consumers over the next few years, and the share is right back in the region of the trend mean. Well, they're probably going to have to do a lot of work to get up to those kinds of numbers, but it is a service that is doing rather well, considering that eBay no longer accepts PayPal. When we look at Amazon, well, Amazon has a history of pulling back to the region of the trend mean and then bouncing. Well, it did that again in here today, and it was a natural area where support could be found, and now we're starting to see at least the first evidence that support is in fact being found here. So this is important because these are the kinds of shares that have been leading on the upside, and more importantly, for companies like Apple and Amazon, they are the largest cap companies in the world. So as long as they're trending higher, they're going to represent a tailwind for the wider market. But then we have to think about the smaller caps or the mid caps. The Russell 2000 has not rallied in here today, and it has gone from being among the best performers and to being one of the laggards. And that is, I think, something that we do need to pay attention to, because the Russell 2000 has been the best performing index over the course of this year so far in terms of leadership. Not, I think it's arguable whether it has been the best performer in terms of absolute percentage gain, but in terms of leadership, which is a temporal designation, it has certainly been something to keep an eye on, because it had done very well in the latter quarter of 2017, then it pulled back early. It found support in the region of the trend mean. It got all the way back up to test its peak, which is something the S&P 500 had not been able to do. Then it was the first index to break on the upside, and that occurred rather early. It was in May that that occurred. Then it pushed on to new high ground in a pretty impressive manner. In fact, it consolidated and then broke out again. So that was looking really quite impressive. But now it has pulled back below the trend mean. Now, leaders tend to lead for a reason, and leaders also tend to lead in both directions. Well, what is the reason that smaller cap indices have been doing better? Well, primarily it's because smaller companies, they rely on access to credit in order to grow their businesses, and credit availability has been extraordinarily accommodative, so they have been able to borrow and invest, and that has helped to expand their businesses in a rapid manner, which has contributed to their outperformance. But of course, that also means that they are interest rate sensitive. Now, this is not simply a US phenomenon. When we look at, for example, the MDAX in Germany, it has been trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner over the course of the last decade, but it didn't rally in here much either today. And it did break below that 25,000 level, and this is a rather dynamic move below the trend mean. Now, it is not the first time that this has occurred. We've seen at least three other instances when the price has pulled back below the trend mean in a dynamic manner over the course of this trend. But one of the more important points is, first, that we're at a higher level now. Second is that each of these rather volatile consolidations is one above another. And then you have the fact that the ECB is no longer engaged in quantitative easing. So there is the possibility that this index is going to bounce, and it could yet sustain a move back above the 25,000. And I think to be really comfortable, it would need to be back above the 26,000 point level. But if it starts to distribute below the trend mean and then breaks down again, well, then we have a very clear type 2 trend ending characteristics. This is already a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. The last instance we had of that was in 2011. We had this very large pullback, then we had the almost textbook example of a period of right-hand extension, but then it was able to push back up again. But that was 7 years ago, and the market has gone up 150% since then. So now it has obviously got a somewhat more difficult time to complete a range and then break higher. But we do have a short-term oversold condition, so there is the potential that we are going to get some ranging between now and when the really big questions are asked about the index. Then when we look at the FTSE 250 in the UK, it's also broken lower. And again, this is not the only occasion on which it has pulled back below the trend mean. The FTSE 250 chart is less consistent than the MDAX because the ranges have tended to dip into one another back in 2015 and 16. So it also needs to bounce in an emphatic manner, and there was a distinct absence of upward dynamics in here today. Then when we look at the small caps in Japan, well, the index has exhibited relative strength. The Japanese small caps have been by far the best performers in this commonality sector over the course of the last few weeks, and they continue to hold this 7,000 level. Then when we look at the Australian mid-cap sector, well, that also shares the commonality that we see with other mid-caps and small-caps, and it had broken below its trend mean in here this week. But it did steady, but it has to do more than that. It needs to push back above the trend mean to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. So what does this tell us? That we have the technology sector that is certainly moving back into a position of outperformance. We've had a temporary outperformance by small caps, but that they are generally more interest rate sensitive. So why is it that they're underperforming right now? Well, it's, we don't really have to look very far. It's that US Treasury yields are consolidating above this 3% level that they pushed up to 3.25%. Last week we've had some consolidation, but we certainly haven't had a dynamic move on the downside. That if yields were to start to compress, well, then that would be suggestive of perhaps that investors are looking for a safe haven. And this is a rather interesting situation because on the one hand you have the stock market, which is increasingly getting a headwind in terms of its exposure to interest rates because yields are rising. Well, why are yields rising? It's not necessarily because of inflationary pressures. Inflation, though, at least the way the Federal Reserve measures inflation, has been rather muted. But they are continuing to raise interest rates because they're trying to drain some of the liquidity out of the system so that they will have some resources at their disposal for when the next recession occurs. And the economy has got a potential risk of overheating, considering that we are at that the US government is engaged in a massive fiscal stimulus, and that continues to influence the market. There is unemployment that is at 50-year lows, and then you have the fact that there's very little inflation. Well, that does hold out the prospect of continued expansion in the economy, and generally speaking, that should put upward pressure on yields, But of course, there's the fact that the fiscal stimulus needs to be paid for, and that represents a massive source of additional new supply of bonds over the course of the next few years. And that also is something that is going to affect the economy sooner or later, because the amount of money that the US government is spending on its interest expense is going to be rising sharply over the course of the next few years. The red line here shows us the net interest that needs to be paid on the US debt. So it's going to supersede Medicaid in 2019 and potentially even supersede defense spending in 2022. Well, that's going to represent a challenge for the US economy. If we were to think about what is it that is likely to represent a headwind, well, how is it that the US government is going to fund itself when its interest expense is going higher? Well, they're either going to have to raise interest rates or there's going to have to be new sources of demand to buy their bonds. Well, the Chinese are not particularly enamored with the idea of buying more US treasuries. And their renminbi is weakening. The Chinese had been sterilizing their imports in order to arrest the advance of the renminbi, but now they are weighing on the financial sector, and the financial sector has been, there are two parts to it, the state-owned part, which is the listed part and represents some of the largest banks in the world, is gaining increasing evidence of support from the government, and it bounced in here today to hold its sequence of higher reaction lows, which is exactly what it needed to do. But the unlisted sector and the shadow banking sector are being heavily weighed upon, and that's rather difficult to monitor. Well, when we look at the A-share index, then it was in positive territory in here today, but not in such a dynamic manner that it was clearly indicating that we're going to see a break in the sequence of lower rally highs. Thought at the risk of being somewhat off color, I thought I would share this graphic that a subscriber kindly sent over with you. And it's basically because this is now the year of the dog. This is what a witty trader drew over the chart pattern for the A shares up until the lows that we saw just last month. So that's a measure of what sentiment is like in the Chinese market right now. Now, when we look at this trend that's persisted for just about all of this year, then it needs to break the sequence of lower rally highs to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And there's a good chance that we're going to see at least a partial rally next week when we think, for example, that some of the US-listed Chinese companies posted upside weekly key reversals this week. Ctrip has been rallying just about all day, and now it has strung together an upside key reversal yesterday and upside follow through in here today. Well, that really confirms a low of at least near term significance, and potentially now that it could at least muster a rally back up towards the trend mean. Alibaba, having broken down from its overhead trading range, was also in somewhat more positive territory in here today, and even Tencent, which has been accelerating on the downside, was in positive territory in here today. So there is certainly the potential that even that we've seen some acceleration in chart patterns, and now there is the potential for a reversionary rally that will at least unwind the oversold condition. Quite whether then some of these Chinese markets can muster the wherewithal to break their downtrends is very much open to question. There is a realistic possibility that we're going to get some form of state sponsorship for the stock market, which could help to reignite investor interest. So that's, I think, something that investors are waiting for. Generally speaking, big upside moves in Chinese shares tend to be state-sponsored. When in a market where you do not have improving standards of governance, where you don't have a free press, a free judiciary, or respect for minority shareholder interests, or indeed then you also have the fact that there is an increasingly overbearing state presence on the lives of individual people, and it is essentially now a dictatorship where you have increasing interference within the management of companies and the subsuming of the profit motivation for political motivations. These are all factors that have weighed on the stock market, but what they also mean is that when the government decides that it is a priority to support the stock market, then it takes off like a rocket, and we have ample evidence of that if we look at the longer-term history of the A-shares. We had a spectacular advance back in from 2005 until 2007. Then we had another extraordinary advance in 2014. Well, we're not there just yet. And certainly we're going to need some form of indication from the Chinese authorities that they are either abandoning their tightening regime on the shadow banking sector, or that they are willing to engage in fiscal stimulus to really get the ball moving again in terms of the economy, in order to really start to get the domestic stock market moving. So then when we think about what exactly is it that is going on in the world, well, there is this continued breakdown in the play along to get along way of thinking about global relationships. We went for almost 30 years where people were willing to look past the breaking of rules or the reneging on agreements because it was more expedient to do so, because people were making money. Well, what has now, and in the aftermath of the credit crisis, been revealed is that globalization has been was a bad bet that was made by the West, and particularly the USA, on encouraging China to adopt liberalism, and that has failed. What was paid in terms of, or what was wagered when that risk was taken, was the livelihoods of millions of people in Europe and in North America, and those people are now voting, and they are reneging on the status quo. Well, what Mike Pence said in his speech at the Hudson Institute last week really highlights that there is the real potential that the USA is moving towards a cold war with China, that the rather cozy relationship that's been adopted most particularly between Wall Street and China, and the political establishment and China, is breaking down, and that is representing a quite considerable knock-on effect. China has already there's a lot of disagreement about whether the USA is going to label China as a currency manipulator, but China last year already labeled the USA as a geostrategic competitor, and that tells us more about where China sees its place in the world than anything about what the USA is doing. Well, the hacking scandal that broke last week, where the integrity of the Chinese supply chain for the technology sector is going to have wide-ranging, medium-term repercussions, because people can no longer trust that anything that is manufactured in China hasn't got some form of backdoor for the Chinese administration to steal information. And that is something that is now weighing on the indices that of countries that have got factories there. So, for example, Taiwan pulled back in a very dynamic manner over the last 2 weeks. Well, the Taiwanese have got large numbers of factories in China, Foxconn, which is dual listed because it's also referred to as Hanhai Precision. But the share is was down in a dynamic manner in here this week. Hanhai Precision is another example of a company with just massive exposure to the industrial base in China, and that represents a significant cost if they have to pull their manufacturing out of China. And of course, there is the very big question about whether it is even possible to pull manufacturing out of China. That if you decide to close your factory, who's to say that they can't simply confiscate the plant and machinery and simply continue to run it under different ownership? So these do represent significant challenges for companies that have invested heavily in manufacturing in or on the Chinese mainland. So Samsung Electronics is another example. The share had been offering some evidence that it was bouncing just a few weeks ago, but it has so far failed to push back above the trend mean, and it really has a lot of work to do. This does not look like an especially bullish pattern, and it needs to push back above the trend mean here to really demonstrate that that this isn't top formation development. So these are, I think, rather important considerations from a corporate perspective, and they are weighing on the respective indices in the region. Then you also have the impact that it's having on the respective currencies, because it's looking increasingly likely that the Chinese are going to let the renminbi continue to weaken. And then on a competitive basis, that means that its neighboring economies are also going to have to do the same thing. Well, the Indonesian rupee, rupiah, and the Indian rupee don't need any additional help in terms of the weakness that they've been encountering. Well, they were both a little bit steadier in here today, but certainly not in a dynamic manner, and nothing yet to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Well, when we think about what exactly is going on in India, it's mostly about the banking sector. And the RBI has been weighing on the banking sector because they want them to try and clean up their non-performing loans problems. Well, we started to see just the first evidence this week of the sector starting to come back and or to attract investor interest once more. So that's, I think, a positive development. It's almost been up one day and down the next, but we've started to string together a couple of days on the upside now. So that is at least a short-term low that is evident on the Bombay Banks Index. Then, if we look at, for example, Yes Bank, it has also started to rally here. It's got a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean. I don't think we're going to have real evidence that a low is in until we have a higher reaction low. In this kind of circumstance, it is quite likely that we're going to get a retest of the low before we see clear evidence of a return to demand dominance. But the much bigger picture here is that India is a very big potential beneficiary of the stress that is evolving between the USA and China. Because India is obviously a large population country, but they don't have a lot of manufacturing. I'm certainly when I go shopping, I always look at where products are manufactured, and I am seeing more clothing being manufactured in India. India also has a large pharmaceuticals production, and it has been one of the primary destinations for offshoring in terms of the back office and call centers. But what it needs is manufacturing, with a massive young population where 50% of people are under the age of 26. This is a massive demographic dividend. And on top of that, you have the fact that 4G has been rolled out to the entire country over the last 18 months. Reliance Industries, having been really very overextended relative to the trend mean, has bounced in here this week, and that is a pretty dynamic move from the region of the trend mean. Well, they owned the 4G network. So, in addition to the demographic dividend, India also has the potential for a digital revolution within the economy, considering that it has gone from 2G to 4G in just the last 12 months. They're still working through how it's all going to be regulated and who's and what kind of data and information about individuals is going to be available to companies. But these are the kinds of questions that tend to arise when you have rule of law. And it's probably going to take a little bit of time to get things up and running, but these are secular themes, and they're the kinds of things that are likely to contribute to India outperforming over the longer term. Not least because China's economy is now so much larger that it takes a lot more in terms of improvements and reforms and adoption of better governance to transform from a mid-income country to a developed economy. And there is a realistic possibility that because of everything that is going on in the world right now, that China is going to get stuck as a middle-income company or country. India isn't there yet. It has got a lot of challenges ahead of it. One of the things that has been fundamental that Modi's government has really pioneered is a sanitation program, and the numbers of people defecating on in public have really collapsed over the last few years. So this is something that is very important from a public sanitation perspective, because when people are healthier, they are more productive, and that is something that can really help to drive economic growth over the long term. So I continue to think that India is the kind of market that is best bought following reactions. And it might be a little early just yet to conclude that we can sound the all clear, but we're certainly a lot closer to that than we were a couple of months ago. Well, it's the rise of the global consumer that is one of the key bullish considerations from from a long-term global investor's perspective. And India represents where a good many of those new consumers are going to come from. Well, so does Africa. But Africa is at a much earlier stage of development than India is, and the standards of governance are nowhere near where they are in India, and India is already rife with corruption. So what we need to see is improving standards of governance in the various high population African countries. And when we think about, for example, the Nigerian index, well, it's heavily influenced by what happens with the oil price. So, but it has also been falling over just about all of this year. So this does not, I think, really cry out that the decline is imminently over, or that governance is necessarily improving. Whereas when we look at, for example, the Africa Opportunities Fund, it has also been pulling back, but it has more of a base formation characteristic over the course of the last 3 years, and it has much more of a focus on evolving consumers. Africa is the kind of market that, because it is illiquid and therefore also interest rate sensitive, that in a bull market environment it tends to do extraordinarily well. But when we start to see credit coming out of the system, then it also tends to pull back in a violent manner, and I think that is what we're seeing right now. Well, if we think about what are the risks, well, I think that it's China represents the epicenter of risk, but it is followed closely by Europe. And the fact that the DAX index has broken downwards in here this week and really did not rally in here, well, there's a good chance it's going to rally on Monday, for the simple reason that Wall Street has finished pretty much on the high of the day in here on Friday. But it has a lot of work to do to push back above this 12,000 level on a sustained basis. Then when we look at, for example, the CAC 40 in France, well, that has also pulled back in a dynamic manner in here this week, but it has not broken down below its most recent lows, and 5,000 continues to represent an area of potential support. If we string them together and look at the Euro Stoxx index, this week has represented a very clear downward break from what is essentially a head and shoulders top over the last 18 months. Well, why is it that Europe is under such duress at the present time? Well, there are some very big questions that are being asked about the integrity of the European Union. One of the effects of Brexit is that, generally speaking, the British MEPs have been with some notable exceptions, have been more moderate. And they're not going to be in the next European elections. Well, the Italians have or the well the Italian Eurosceptic parties have been rather keen to highlight the potential that the Eurosceptic parties could control the European elections or the European Parliament after the next election in May of 2019. Well, the Italian index has been ranging for a decade. It encountered resistance at the upper side of that range earlier this year, and it continues to trend lower. The populist administration is thumbing its nose at the status quo. They are betting, in no uncertain terms, that, and this is an awfully big risk, but they are betting that it is the European elections are going to deliver a potential vindication for their strategy to blow out the fiscal deficits. Well, when we look at, for example, the potential for that to occur, when we look at the European Parliament estimates right now, they are thinking that if the centre-right declines and the centre-left declines, and if we think about the potential for that, there's quite a high possibility that that will in fact occur, then it is potentially Eurosceptic parties will benefit, and it could take them to the largest weighting within the Parliament. But that's nowhere near 50%. Could the Eurosceptic parties rely on the left and the Greens? Even if they were to do that, then centre-left, centre-pro-EU, and the centre-right are unlikely to vote with the Eurosceptic bloc. So the potential here that Italy is going to is well, they are already betting that they're going to win the European elections and try and get the fiscal rules reversed. Well, this doesn't look particularly likely, and but it does mean that there's going to be a lot more Eurosceptic voices in Parliament, and it could potentially result in a grand coalition of the centrist parties to really start to change the outlook here. Well, when we look at the bond markets, the 10-year yield on Italian debt has first step above the base characteristics, and it broke up out of that first step above the base this week, not in a particularly dynamic manner, but it continues to hold the breakout. When we just zoom in and look at it on a daily basis, it's been consolidating above the 3.5% level all week, and it really would need a very clear downward dynamic, and more particularly a sustained move below the trend mean, to question that this isn't a supply-dominated environment. What it is also worth taking a look at is, for example, if we look at the 10-year on Spain's government bond debt. Well, this is where we see evidence that the ECB is still buying, but Spain's bond yield has been pushing up this week. Now, there's a pretty substantial yield differential between Spain and Italy right now, but that's the Spanish yield coming back up towards the upper side of its range, and it's now challenging the sequence of lower rally highs. 2% is a big level for Spain. And there is the realistic possibility that the trouble that is evolving in Italy, and most particularly if and what's happening over the course of the next month is first that the Italians are going to adopt this budget deficit model, then you're going to have Moody's and S&P deciding whether they're going to downgrade the debt, and on the balance of probabilities, then they could well do that. But Italy's debt is already triple B, so a downgrade from here takes it into junk. And if it is downgraded to junk, then there are a significant number of pension funds will have to sell. So that's a potential powder keg for the Italian market. Then you have the powder keg in May, because you're going to have a big surge in Eurosceptic members of the European Parliament. It points towards the potential that when we think about that the German stock market is starting to deteriorate, the Euro stocks, which is the pan-Euro stock market, has also broken lower. And then you have revolts starting to appear on the periphery, where you have the populist parties have gained control of Italy, then you have Orban in Hungary, and then you've had Poland has been sanctioned by the EU for some of its politicians' views. So this is evidence of it's almost a move to the fringe on the fringe of the EU. Well, that is eventually going to have an influence on policy, because it is very much in Germany's interest to ensure that the EU is holds together. But the problem that they have right now is that Bavarian-dominated CSU and CDU is very much against the idea of funding fiscal largesse on the periphery. So that is pointing towards a showdown in Europe. And it could potentially result in the end of the Eurozone. Or it's going to perhaps more likely result in an adoption of fiscal stimulus in exactly the same way that the USA is doing right now. Because we have ample evidence that this fiscal stimulus that the USA is engaged in has contributed to almost record low unemployment and outsized economic growth. But until we get that change, then Europe's markets are probably going to remain under pressure, despite the fact that they're trading at a pretty substantial discount to what we're seeing in the USA in particular. Well, that is, I think, pointing towards the fact that we have trouble in China and we have trouble in Europe, although perhaps less trouble. Then we have the US, which has just gone through a period of volatility, but it's still exhibiting relative strength. Now, the question is, if something that we've often talked about is the Wall Street leash effect. And the Wall Street leash effect really suggests that it's the rest of the world follows Wall Street. But the rest of the world is now a lot bigger than it used to be, and there is the possibility that we will get a case of the tail wagging the dog, that it will be trouble in the rest of the world will act as a brake on the kinds of advance we might otherwise expect on Wall Street. So we're at, I think, a rather interesting juncture right now. Well, we've talked a little bit about the rise of the global consumer, and The fact of the matter is that we've been seen millions of people lifted up and out of abject poverty over the course of the last 30 years, and most particularly because they've adopted capitalism and improving standards of governance. And as long as countries continue to adopt that kind of model, we can anticipate that that process of improving standards of living for the majority of humanity is going to persist. It's being certainly being encouraged by improving standards of governance, but then you also have technological innovation. And the two major points that are really helping to drive that forward are the rise of, or I guess the innovation that we're getting in the energy sector, where oil prices have been trending higher now for most of the last 3 years, and $80 is a big psychological level here for Brent crude. And if it's going to remain consistent, and there's certainly no guarantee of that, considering that we're talking about oil prices, which don't have a history of being particularly consistent, but as long as it's holding the region of the trend mean, then we're still in a trending environment generally. But it's the fact that you now have the USA has turned from being the biggest consumer of oil to being a net exporter, or to at least being an exporter, is a massive sea change in the energy environment. It is also a great example of the ability of private enterprise to really innovate when prices are low. And that goes back to the Jevons paradox, that there is not much of an incentive for producers to innovate when prices are high. That's where consumers innovate. That's when you get people switching from incandescent bulbs to LEDs, and from gas guzzlers to smaller cars or electric cars. It's when prices are low that you get true innovation in terms of supply. It was back in 2006 and 7 that we started to first hear of hydraulic fracturing coupled with horizontal drilling. And that had really only started in 2004 and 5 when prices were low and small wildcat producers had to try something new in order to survive. So prices now at about $80 are in between low and high. But we are seeing a continued innovation in the battery sector. And that is not occurring at nearly the same pace of innovation that we saw in semiconductors, but it is occurring. And the energy density of batteries is improving all the time. What we also have evidence of is that we're not going to have a one-size-fits-all solution to batteries, that there are obviously power-to-weight ratios that have to be considered for transportation, and you don't have those when you consider utilities. So that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have one a type of battery that is going to dominate the world, but rather that there's potential for both. Well, vanadium batteries are much more attuned to the utilities sector, and lithium batteries, or indeed silicon lithium batteries, are potentially the answer for transportation. But this will eventually occur, that we will have more batteries in the system that will smooth out the production of electricity, that will reduce the requirement for backup supply. And that will also help to reduce costs. And when we look at oil prices over the very long term, well, what we're presented with is an environment which is step sequence in nature. That historic oil prices tend to go through these extraordinarily lengthy ranges, and then they have incredible bull markets, and then they go through very lengthy ranges again. Well, we had a phenomenal bull market. Prices went up 10 times between or during the commodity bull that began in 1998 and ended all the way back in 2008. We've been ranging for a decade. Well, the last time prices ranged, they ranged for 25 years. So there is the potential here that prices could be ranging between $30 and $100 for the next 15 years. And that's, I think, fits rather interestingly into the same time frame that we could potentially see the next peak in the Dow Gold ratio. This ratio, we've got lots of back history. The two things that I find most important about it is that there is approximately 35 years between the peaks, and each peak is higher than the last. Well, when we go back and think about what the longer term perspective is, that the real risk is in China and in Europe. Well, the USA could end up coming out of all of this, these geopolitical considerations that are being taken into account today, in a relatively better position. And if that does in fact occur, well, that is the kind of thing that can help to generate a bull market that could take this ratio to double where it is today. But that is not going to happen all in one go. And gold prices were really quite firm in here this week. And considering how much gold has underperformed the stock market this year in particular, it does have ample potential here to bounce. $1,200 is pretty close to the lower side of this range that's been evolving for 3 years. If it can sustain a move, or sustain the move above $1,200, then we can start to think about the potential for recovery. When we look at the fact that this is the biggest upward dynamic this week that we've seen since at least February, well, that suggests that there has been some short covering has come into this market. It is being led higher by the platinum price. Platinum being a much smaller market, it tends to be more easily influenced by capital flowing in, and platinum prices have pushed up into the overhead trading range. They've broken the progression of lower rally highs, and it's looking increasingly likely that they're going to go back up and test the lower side of this overhead trading range, which pretty much coincides with the region of the trend mean today. Well, gold does best when it's appreciating in all currencies, and right now it's appreciating against about half of them. Then it really does best as well when central banks are not raising interest rates as quick as they need to. Well, right now the Federal Reserve is raising rates faster than it needs to on, I guess, a strictly academic consideration. And that has weighed on precious metal prices. But with the risk that we do have on the geopolitical front, there is the scope here for some interest to return to the precious metal sector. And not least because precious metals are cheap right now relative to the valuations that we see on stock markets and indeed in bond markets in particular. The reality is here that inflation-protected bonds have sustained the move above 1%, and this represents a breakout from a 5-year range. And there is no additional new supply of TIPS that are being priced in here. So that is an indication that something really major is occurring. Well, when we look at the total return on the 10-year Treasury, the most important point we can draw, and again, it goes right back to the chart seminar. If you were trying to describe this chart to a blind person, what would you say? Well, you could say that it only went up between the early 1980s and approximately 2016. And since 2016, it stopped going up. It hasn't quite broken down yet, but it went up for almost 30 years, and then it stopped going up. Well, That tells us that something has changed in terms of the supply and demand dynamics that have been active in this market for a long time. And the fact that you're now getting this breakdown in the status quo politically, that it is the fringe parties that are gaining adherence and are coming to power in an increasingly large number of countries, and that you're getting a more ambiguous, or I think, excuse me, ambivalent relationship between the two largest trading or economies in the world. This points towards a change, and it suggests that the debt-fueled environment that has been able to paper over a lot of cracks and in terms of deteriorating governance, and the fact that the futures of millions of workers in Europe and North America have been mortgaged on the bet that China would liberalize. Well, that's over. And there is now the possibility that we're going to move into a bipolar environment where countries will be asked to make a decision on whose side they're on. I agree really quite closely with Russell Napier on that particular point. And that's likely to represent a source of volatility. But the more important point is that when you look at China, that the lack of governance is something that is going to endanger the security of foreign investments in the country. The fact is that the property prices in China have been trending higher for decades. They haven't had a recession in about 30 years, and there is the potential that this is the kind of environment that could really put pressure on their economy. So that is an additional reason for thinking that they are going to adopt a fiscal stimulus to try and avoid that particular, I think, potentially realistic outcome. So that is also likely to put upward pressure on yields. If we see the global economy moving towards a more fiscal stimulus perspective, not just for the USA but for a lot of additional markets, well, that's likely to inflate asset prices again, but it's also likely to be beneficial for the stock market, but it will eventually kick up inflation. And inflationary pressures are death to the stock, to the bond markets. So that's if we're going to think about where the risks are, well, the risk is in China, the risk is in the bond markets, and the risk is in Europe. It is in the technology sector that we see the potential for growth. It's in the companies that have got a long history of increasing their dividends beyond the pace with which inflation is rising represents growth. Then, of course, if we are moving into a more inflationary environment, well, there is one country more than any other has been trying to chase inflation for the last 30 years, and that is Japan. And the Nikkei pulled back really very sharply in here this week, but we're starting to see evidence of support starting to come back in the region of the trend mean. So I think it is in Japan where we have some of the clearest potential for inflation to have a positive effect. And then you also have the potential that it is likely to benefit from the or it's got a lot of potential to benefit as both a center of gravity within Asia and a perhaps a more strident geopolitical position as a bastion for good governance, particularly on a relative basis compared to its neighbors. So there is certainly the potential that Japan is moving back into a secular bull market, and it trades at a significant discount to Wall Street right now. So I think the other point is that it is in Japan where we have had less volatility and greater evidence that the mid-cap sector is still doing well. But we're also starting to see that JGB yields are pushing higher. And the Bank of Japan has been rather clear in signaling that they want to defend the 15 basis point level, and the yield is right at that level today. But if we were to take the labels off the chart, this looks like a completing base formation. So there is the potential here that the Japanese market is going to move into a more bullish environment. And the banking sector has also pulled back violently this week, but it's been ranging now for 18 months. And as long as it's holding the region of the lower side of that range, I think we do have the potential that it can break up and away from this very lengthy ranging phase that's been persisting since 2013. Then, when I think it's also worth talking a little bit about the Bitcoin price today. The price has been bumping off of 6,000 since February, and that was following the big crash that we had down from the peak around 19,500. Volatility has been squeezed out of the market, but the sequence of lower rally highs remains intact. Now, if we look at this on a weekly basis, there is nothing particularly sacrosanct about 6,000. There is the really quite clear potential that the cryptocurrency market is going to evaporate over the course of the next few years, but that blockchain will persist. And blockchain has the potential to streamline the financial sector and remove significant blockages that inhibit growth. So we have energy on the one hand, we have financial innovation, and then we also have healthcare that is really being driven higher by the incredibly quick pace of innovation in genetics that has the potential to transform healthcare provision over the course of the next decade. So that cancer no longer represents the one of the biggest sources of expenditure for humanity, that heart disease becomes less of an issue, that people live longer and more productive lives, which contributes to workforce productivity. Well, those are important bullish characteristics that are outside of the economic or the economic cycle. They're more in terms of the technology cycle, which tends to be longer running. The other important point is that despite the fact that we have had an uptick in volatility this week, the yield curve spread is now at 30 basis points, so we're starting to see a little bit of an expansion rather than a contraction, although it is still trending lower on a medium-term basis. Unemployment is still at very low levels. The banking sector in the USA was really very volatile over the last three sessions, but it showed at least nascent support around the lower side of its range in here today. That helps to really ram home the point that this is we're certainly seeing evidence of US exceptionalism because European banking sectors are trending lower. And the Chinese banking sector has at least bounced. Well, banks are liquidity providers, and they tend to do well in a liquidity-rich environment. So that tells us that it is Europe that has the least liquidity-rich environment right now, and some of the biggest questions being asked about the integrity of the balance sheets of its banks. So it's not as if we have nothing to worry about right now, but the fact is we have short-term oversold conditions, and there is potential here for a bounce. What happens after we get that bounce is probably going to give us a lot more information about the integrity of the bull markets that have been underway now, particularly on Wall Street since 2009, and whether the it is possible for Europe to rehabilitate after the big declines that we've seen this year, excuse me, this week. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.